monologue.
I'll give you a little bit of a hint of this exclusive story on the show yesterday, but I can get into more details now. The Seattle Police Department lost an astonishing number of officers last year. The final tally has been officially entered into the record, and it stands at 170 officers. But the truth is, that only tells a little bit of the story, just part of the story, because as you know, as we've been covering, dozens more will be separated from the department in the coming weeks, a result of the former mayor's vaccine mandate, and in truth, now the current mayor's vaccine mandate. Bruce Harrell said he is not getting rid of this mandate. At least they said they have no announcement yet that they are getting rid of this mandate. Now, this final separations report includes retirements, resignations. It comes after, what, a year of anti-police activism? More than that. A vaccine mandate that sidelined upwards of, what, 100 officers? And some of those officers are still going through the accommodation repeal process. Some of them ended up quitting. Some of them ended up complying with the mandate. But there are others that are still on the list as they're waiting for their inevitable firing. And it will occur unless Bruce Harrell changes it. But again, he said he's not going to, at least as of now. The interim police chief, Adrian Diaz, is calling this crisis-level staffing. He's right. The union for the police, Mike Solon, is calling this off-the-charts dangerous. He's right. And what's worse, now the SPD will tell you that the deployable officer number is around 950. It's actually 948, according to the SPD communications department. Now, that's technically true. However, it's not all that accurate in the context of how many officers are actually out in the field or could be out in the field. That number is not 948. That 948 stat includes recruits not yet sworn in, students in field training, and it also includes the unavailable officers list. Now, the number of deployable sworn officers that are members of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, the union, is 880. 880. The number should be about 1,500 to 1,600 minimum, and we're at 880. SPOG President Mike Solon told me last night via email, the current state of Seattle police staffing is off the charts dangerous for our community. Now, making matters worse, there are about 187 or so officers on this HR unavailable list. We've talked about it in the past. This is the list that has officers on extended leave. You have to be out for 14 days before you get put on this list. And people are on this list for a variety of reasons. Injury, military service, but it also, of course, lists officers who are using their paid time off, whether it's vacation time or sick time, all of it accrued over years of service, and they could have lots and lots and lots of this time, months worth, even years worth, depending how long they've been on the force. And a lot of times, officers, before leaving the department, will use up their time off that they earned. You had the year before 180 separations, putting the Seattle Police Department at a historic 350 officers gone since 2020 before we account for the officers that technically should be counted from last year, the ones who are going to be fired over the mandate, but weren't fired last year, will be fired this year, which makes last year's numbers look somewhat less dire. Do not fall for it. Do not fall for it. And remember that media outlets here virtually silent on this. They were silent for the last 3, 4, 5 years on the staffing issues there. I reported back in October that the separations at that point was 335, which means the acceleration of retirements or resignations occurred in the final months of last year. And just to give you some context, SPD in 2019 saw 95 separations. This is remarkable, and it's very clear the vaccine mandate made a staffing situation worse, and there's no indication that anyone is going to change course. The only people really who have changed course over the last 2 years are the criminals who have felt emboldened to continue to commit acts of violence, criminal acts, stealing from your business, from your home, selling drugs openly on the streets, committing acts of assault. They're doing this because they know they can get away with it, because we know we don't have enough police officers. At the same time, in the month of December, because Seattle Fire Department is going through the same issues, I don't have their final staffing numbers yet, but I can tell you that they had 175 total units offline over the month of December. 175 in total. Some of them were out for 12 hours. Some of them were out for 24 hours. The city of Seattle, all of us are living dangerously right now. Very dangerously. And there's no end in sight.
The interview.
Well, he fought the COVID law, at least in Olympia, and the COVID law, at least in Olympia, won. Joining me on the line is State Senator Phil Fortunato, who today found himself kicked off the Capitol campus. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Jason.
You're a scofflaw, Phil. Tell us what happened.
Well, basically, I chose to ignore their new little Senate rule that said you had to be tested like 3 times a week. You get tested, and then that lasts for 3 days. So if you want to be down in Olympia, you got to be tested 2 times a week. And you had to show your negative test and in order to get admission to the Senate chambers. In my case, my office is in the legislative building above the Senate chambers. And, I just feel, hey, this is a condition of employment for me to do my job. I don't recall that being in the Constitution. So this is a constitutional issue for me. And the advantage that I have that some other people didn't have when they quit their job or got fired because they didn't want to do these COVID rules is you may not have a constitutional right to your job, but I do.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the reasons why I want to make this point. This is a constitutional issue. They are denying me access to the legislative building and to being seated on the Senate floor because I choose not to get tested. Now, and actually, it's not so much the test. It's the test release form is ridiculous. We brought it up to our lawyers, and they go, oh, this isn't enforceable. And I said, well, if it's not enforceable, why is it in there?
Exactly. What is so absurd about the release form?
Well, one of the things said is, now bear in mind, you're talking about being able to do your job, being able to represent the people in your district. And they say in the release form, which probably every one of them says, is, hey, there's false positives and false negatives. Okay, so you're telling me that I could have a false positive and be denied access to represent the people in my district. I would have to leave and then and go home, I guess, and do it remotely. Well, you could do it remotely. You don't have to go into the legislature. Well, that's true. Okay, but that's not the point. The point is you're denying me access based on this new requirement for my condition of employment, which I think is a constitutional issue. In addition to that, it says if you do test positive, that you have to do certain things. You have to do this, 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 and this. Well, if I test positive, I'm going to determine what I'm going to do. I would probably quarantine. I would probably, leave, go home, quarantine, stay away from people, do whatever.
Yeah.
But that's my choice. I don't have to go through a medical procedure that you say I have to do.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. But here's my question for you, Senator. Obviously, we know that there are at least constitutional concerns. We're obviously waiting to see whether or not a judge will ultimately decide on on this issue in a reasonable way. But you kind of knew what was going to happen. So what's next? Will you challenge this or will the caucus challenge this in court?
Well, we're going to see what's going to happen, whether they back off or whatever. I mean, if other senators, for example, don't want to be around me because I choose not to get tested, okay, I'll stay in my office, right? But no, you can't do that. Why can't I just stay in my office? And then anybody knows in there knows I haven't been tested. And what's wrong with that? Nope, can't do that. Somebody has to push back on this absurdity. We're 700 days into this. This is going to be with us forever.
Yeah.
I mean, the only real positive thing here is that COVID cured the flu and cured pneumonia. Nobody's dying of the flu and nobody's dying of pneumonia anymore. Everybody's dying of COVID. And I was going to run a bill to name the next variant. This is going to go on forever. And so if that's the case, at some point in time, people have to assess their own risk and what they're going to do and make their own decisions. I mean, in King County, this stupid, idiotic thing saying you can't go into a restaurant and eat inside if you're not, if you don't haven't been vaccinated, when 50% of the people in the hospital are vaccinated.
Yeah. We only have about 15 seconds. So very quickly, do you plan now to do the remainder of work from your home?
Well, I think we're going to try again on Wednesday, see what happens. I may go out and get tested someplace that doesn't have a release form that I object to, and see what happens. Otherwise, we'll do the rest by remote.
It's so ridiculous. State Senator Phil Fortunato, best of luck on all of this. We really appreciate you telling your story.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Now this.
The Monologue.
Today, President Joe Biden, ahead of that really failed photo op in Georgia on voting rights, talked about his attack of the COVID crisis, the one that he said, that virus he said he would eliminate when he was running for president and when he started the president. I mean, in fairness, he already said we kind of won the battle with COVID. Well, now he is changing his tune. We talked about last week his position that it's no longer something the federal government can tackle. It's now up to the states, which is weird because Republicans were saying the feds aren't going to be able to tackle this. It has to be up to the states. Give us some more, you know, power and resources when available, and we'll do it. And of course, when Florida was able to get it under control and handle the surges, they were attacked. DeSantis was attacked. And when California wasn't able to get it under control, or New York, for example, it was the federal government's fault under Trump. It's very weird. It's kind of hard to figure out exactly where it is they stand. But we do know that Biden now says we're on the right track.
Well, I am concerned about the pandemic just because it worldwide is not slowing up very much.
Okay, so just real quick. He's concerned about the pandemic because worldwide it's not slowing. But here, I guess it is. Now, worldwide, we're kind of seeing what we expected to see. It depends on, obviously, where in the world you're looking. But we expect to see the, we just talked about this, we expect to see the surge sort of peak within the next couple of days or so and then start to come down. Now, in reality, the reason why we came up with that general timeline is we look towards what happened in South Africa, which is, last time I checked, a part of the world in which it is under control. So let's hear him continue to set up his talking points for blaming the global pandemic instead of what's happening here, so he doesn't have to take any of the blame.
And thank God, what we've been able to do is generate significant federal help in terms of folks both coming into the hospitals and administering all the help that these states need. Uh-huh. That's what we're doing now, but I'm confident we're on the right track.
He's confident we're on the right track. Okay. But you're still pushing for the vaccine mandates. People still can't get tests at all. It's very difficult to find tests still. It's very difficult to get appointments for tests still. And he's just buying time because once the supply starts to kick in, he'll, of course, take credit for that. But what's interesting here, especially at least to me, is this idea that, you know, globally things are not under control, according to him. And that's his big concern. He's saying that now because he's going to compare the global response to the U.S. response. And again, we know that the surge is going to start to go away or start to subside within the next couple days. And he's going to pretend that it's because of what he did, even though it's not. It's just the life cycle of this particular surge. When you compare it to other places, it's disingenuous because the places he's going to compare it to in the future are countries that started the surge after we started the surge, which means their surge hasn't peaked or will not have peaked by the time we have. It's very disingenuous. But also, there was a comment earlier today at the hearing where Dr. Fauci testified, and obviously we played the battle between he and Senator Rand Paul in the first hour of the show, but Patty Murray was the chair, and she said something so outrageous.
You can't just say our schools must stay open if you don't vote to provide additional resources. Schools need to do so.
Just real quick, did she forget that y'all voted $122 billion? Of funding to give to schools? They got that in the American Rescue Plan. It was bloated. It was filled with all of this garbage. In fact, when you look at even the money that went to the schools, there was no mechanism to guarantee that the schools even had to spend the money right now or immediately on the issues that they claimed they needed the money for. There was a story out last night I saw about Rhode Island squandering the money, all the money for their schools, on things that had nothing to do whatsoever with actually retrofitting the schools with better HVAC systems and whatnot. But I don't understand. Is she saying the schools shouldn't be open, or they should be? Is she saying that Republicans shouldn't criticize anything because they didn't vote for something? Because if that's your case, well, you don't vote for lots of things. It's very weird. But she does see, and maybe that's why her numbers, her polls are so poor. She just doesn't know what she's talking about. But let's be clear. The school's got $122 billion. They should be open.
The interview.
Today, Governor Jay Inslee delivered his State of the State. He made several more demands as we head into this legislative session. It's only day two, and yet there is a lot to be done and very little getting tackled in a meaningful way. Joining me on the line is State Senator Chris Gildon, Republican from Puyallup. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Jason. Glad to be here again.
Obviously, today you focused your response to the state of the state on the emergency powers that Governor Jay Inslee has abused. I know it's only day two, but obviously the conversations have been going on for a while. Do you have enough Democrats to curtail some of the powers that the governor currently enjoys?
You know, I'm not sure if we have enough. I know that there is a growing appetite within the legislature to begin to exert itself once again as a co-equal branch of government. If they're actually going to do this, you know, that remains to be seen. We're in day number two of the session. But, you know, I really think that we've got to act on a number of fronts, as I mentioned in my speech, you know, restoring public trust by fixing the emergency powers and giving the people a voice. We've got to support justice and the rule of law, reduce the cost of living, and we've got to bring people of our state together. I mean, we're just so divided. That was kind of the nexus of my whole speech. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I thought was really interesting, Jason, is that the governor spent probably about 85% of the time on his speech talking about the environment and climate change and policies for electric vehicles or solar or whatever the case. I don't think he just barely mentioned police reform, and he barely mentioned the budget. I think he referenced the budget only to say that he was going to build up the rainy day fund, which obviously we support. That's only a portion of it. I don't think he mentioned emergency reform at all. Why would he?
Right? I mean, he doesn't want to give that up. This is a guy who very clearly has shown himself to be lawless. I mean, this is someone who just last week was talking about how he's going to ban political speech on election integrity that he disagrees with.
Yeah, well, and he went over that quite well in his speech today too. He called it, you know, the big lie, and he wants to make it a misdemeanor, I believe. Which is, I don't know that you move society forward by prohibiting speech.
You very clearly don't, but progressives like to stop people from disagreeing with them because they know that they could lose arguments in so many instances. Long-term care is the Long-Term Care Trust Act is supposed to be fixed. What exactly is the status of that?
Well, it is still a law that's on the books. So my proposal that I've been pushing is we should repeal that week one of session, full on repeal. And then if the majority party wants to take the rest of the section or maybe, you know, through the interim and then bring it up next session and figure out a way that they want to fix it, that's probably the smart thing that they could do. I just don't know that you can fix the thing as it is. And if we delay fixing it or repealing it, then we're just leaving employers and employees in a status of uncertainty all across our state. And that is not the right thing to do.
Is there an issue right now that no one is talking about that people should be paying attention to that's on your radar?
Yeah, absolutely. And the governor mentioned it a little bit when he was talking about housing. And he mentioned it that we need to build more homes and we need to get rid of, he called it, antiquated regulations. What he means whenever he's saying that is from his budget, he's going to be pushing to remove single family zoning from across Washington state and replace that with zoning for duplex, fourplex, some mm-hmm. type of multifamily housing. Not a lot of people are talking about that, but that is going to be a fundamental change to housing policy all across our state. And it's something I think we should be paying attention to.
Last question for you. He has made a move or is about to make a move on affirmative action, which would allow, in this case, getting rid of an executive order that was previously passed by Governor Locke, I think, basically allowing on the state side for state employers to effectively discriminate on the basis of race as a way to meet quotas. Is there going to be any meaningful pushback from the Republicans that could actually stop this from happening? Since every time it comes up for a vote, the voters are very clear they don't want it.
I think the voters are very clear in their desires on this issue. And, you know, it was a key point of my speech today is Olympia needs to listen to the will of the voters, the voice of the voters. People, I can't tell you how many times people have called me, Jason, and said, why should I even vote anymore? Because nobody's listening. You know, we passed $30 car tabs. And what happened to that? We've given input on all of these other advisory votes that I think 19 or 20 of the 22 taxes that were passed in the last 3 years, the people voted against in the advisory ballot. But the legislature, the Democratic majority just comes back year after year and passes tax after tax with no regard to the will of the people of our state. Yeah. And it's high time that we start listening.
I'm with you. State Senator Chris Gildon, Republican from Puyallup. Thank you so much for stopping by, as always. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jason.
Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz has followed that into Taley's radio host in Seattle. He broke the story. He joins us now.
Never shy of his opinion, Jason. Definitely letting you know how he feels about that.
Wow. He laid that down.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
This isn't something you see every day, certainly not on the Republican side and certainly not in the state of Washington. State Representative Robert Sutherland, out of Snohomish County, finds himself in a position where he is being challenged by another Republican, Snohomish County Councilmember Sam Lowe. He was on the show yesterday. Part of this has to do with the fact that the district is changed. The redistricting process has changed the 39th district. So we spoke to Sam Lowe yesterday. Today, we talked to State Representative Robert Sutherland. Representative, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you, Jason. Good to be here.
So first question, of course, is were you expecting to be challenged by, you know, another local Republican?
Was I expecting it? No. Is it unexpected? No. It's been the case almost since I've been elected. I'm a Republican, what I refer to as a real Republican, and we don't always agree with one another within the party. And so there are various factions in the party. I am what I consider a real Republican, believing in the rule of law, Constitution, family, God, you know, the whole bit. And not everyone agrees with that. So, you know, I always expect someone to come out of the woodworks and try to challenge me based on our political differences, I guess.
Well, the implication, obviously, there is that you don't believe that County Councilmember Sam Lowe is a real Republican. Is that what you're saying?
I can't answer because I have my own opinion of what a real Republican is. I believe in the platform. I believe in the Constitution. I believe in the state of Washington and all the things I just listed. Mm-hmm. And everyone will have their own opinion. So you may agree with me on that. You may not. Everyone will either have to make up their own mind whether they agree with me or not. But I have my own opinion. And what I don't want to do is get into name calling and categorizing people. Sam, you know, he has a history of supporting Democrats. Ty Tenery for sheriff, Dave Summers for executive, and others. I have never supported a Democrat. I've always ran against Democrats. And so we might have a political difference in what we think we should be doing as elected officials, and let people decide whether they think the people that don't agree with me and that challenge me for this seat, if they feel that they're a good Republican, then so be it. If they feel they're not a good Republican, then, you know, let them speak out.
The framing of this race by the Everett Herald was around your support for claims from President Trump of election, not just irregularities, but election fraud, and that you have lost some support from Republican moderates. That was their framing and their phrasing. Do you concur with that framing? Do you think you've lost support because of your support of Trump?
Absolutely not. Let me clarify that. This is what they do. They try to link me with someone else, In this case, Trump. I have nothing to do with Trump. I have nothing to do with it. The work I'm doing in Washington State as a state legislator has everything to do with my constituents. They want me to look into election irregularities here in Washington. I spent the last 9 months doing that, and I have found them. So I'm not making claims, broad claims of fraud or corruption. I have found weaknesses in our election system. And I'll give you one example. We are registering people who are not legally U.S. citizens. We are registering them to vote. We are sending them ballots, and they are voting. I spoke with my county auditor, Garfell, and I asked him, how many non-U.S. citizens are voting in Snohomish County? And he acknowledged that there were some, but he didn't know how many.
Okay.
So I've written four pieces of legislation to help strengthen our election system. And if that's a problem with anyone, then I don't know what to say because my constituents want me to do that.
Is your argument or is what you're finding that their votes are being counted or that they are registering and going through the process? Meaning, you know, if I were to register to vote, and let's just say I knew your address and your birthday and I had the information, which is all really easy to find, I voted, I registered in your name and got the ballot. If I were to send that in, are you suggesting that it's being counted, or are you just suggesting that the fact that I can do that is the problem?
That is exactly what. There are many ways that our election systems are failing us right now, Matt, and you just touched on one of them. But the way our system works, the first ballot in is the one that's counted. Someone can walk in the auditor's office, say that they're me. They don't have to show any ID whatsoever. Say they lost their ballot or their dog ate their ballot. They get a provisional ballot, a new ballot. They can vote on my behalf, and if their ballot beats my ballot in, that's the one that's counted. I can vote later, And then I can call in to see if they accepted my ballot. And they'll say, yes, you've already voted. We got your ballot. But I have no idea to know if that's my ballot or someone that voted on my behalf. I have no idea. And that's what's going on right now.
Well, you know, we've heard the same exact thing whenever we've posed that to election officials, including the Secretary of State. We've been told that it doesn't actually get counted, and the right one does get counted because of the behind-the-scenes sort of work that's done to make sure that the ballots are legitimate. I hear you on your concern. I think that you're obviously right in the sense that if anyone can just go ahead and sort of scam the system at the front end, even if it doesn't get counted, it's something that needs to be addressed. And I don't know if it's truly being addressed. I also don't know how big of a problem it is, mostly because we haven't seen the kind of evidence that shows any kind of widespread issues. But the idea of an audit just to constantly, regardless of any claims, just getting in the habit of doing that, I don't necessarily think is a bad idea. We've been talking with State Representative Robert Sutherland. I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, no, you're right. We don't know how extensive this is. That's why I'm not out there calling or claiming widespread fraud of election issues. Garth, I think he has his hands tied. He's not allowed to check for legal citizenship of registered voters. He's not allowed to. So because we don't know, that is why I'm considering calling for an audit of our system, not because I think they're not doing their job best they can, but because we don't know how many votes that are being cast that are not legal votes. We don't know. So why don't we take a look and find out?
And I think that that's reasonable. In fact, let's just go a couple extra minutes since we're already late. When you bring up this idea of your legislation that you've proposed, do you get support from the caucus?
That's an excellent question. I just dropped three pieces of legislation, and I know I have at least a few of my fellow R's that have signed on to it, but I haven't double-checked to see who all is signed on. I think Jim Walsh and McCaslin and Chase, I think they've signed on as co-sponsors to my bill. There might be others, and I'm just not up to date. We're in caucus now. We go on the House floor in a few minutes, so it's very fast-paced here. Haven't been able to even keep an eye on my own bills yesterday and today.
I guess I mean more culturally within the caucus, meaning that there's obviously folks who raise good faith objections to issues or to propose changes or policies, whatever it happens to be. And those folks get attacked as being conspiracy theorists. There are some conspiracy theorists. There's no doubt about that. But the media will generally, you know, paint this very broad brush, even when people act out in good faith. And my impression is that there are some folks who don't want to get caught up in that, and mostly because they want to, you know, they want to stay in power.
You're absolutely right. It's one could make a good case that working on this issue is maybe not the best political move a person could do, an elected official could do. Within the caucus, I would say most people tend to want to shy away, speak about other issues that to a lot of people are more important, public safety being one of them, vaccine mandate. So this isn't the sexiest issue in the world, and because the media continually makes it a controversial one, a lot of members want to shy away from it. I think it happens to be a fundamental principle, a foundation of us as Americans, that if we can't trust our voting systems, our ballots are being received and counted, and that's the one we send in. If we can't trust that, we're in trouble. So I've always come into politics with the way I refer to it is, you know, if it's the right thing to do, I'm going to do it. And I don't care if it's politically popular or not. And I think fixing and helping to strengthen our election systems in Washington State is the right thing to do. And I'm just hoping my constituents agree with me. And I'll tell you, my constituents fully agree with me. We had a public hearing with overflowing crowds. Here in Snohomish and Skagit, we care. And I'm sure they do around the state as well, but I represent the 39th. So the public intent is there. They care that they're losing faith in the system. I'm working on it, and I'm being attacked by the press. And again, it's not the most sexiest idea within my Republican caucus in Olympia. But for the most part, they're just shying away. They're not supporting the Andros, but I do have some support. And I'd like to remind everyone, I don't work for the caucus. I don't work for the political, the Republican Party. I work for my constituents here in the 39th, and they're demanding we do something. They're demanding we fix this problem, and we have problems. I've located them, and I'm working on them, and I have bills to address some of them.
There you go. People will get to decide. Obviously, they're going to be deciding between right now two Republicans, and perhaps there'll be others jumping into the race. Certainly on the Democratic side, there's going to be some challengers. We've been talking with State Representative Robert Sutherland. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Jason, thanks for having me. I look forward to talking to you again.
Absolutely. Now this.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle, top radio host Jason Rants. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rants is in focus now.
Jason Rants, thank you for your reporting on that.
The Quick Hit.
We have an update on the situation in the city of Kent with the Kent Assistant Chief Camerzell, who is now facing significant pushback and the threat of termination. In fact, that's likely what's going to happen, even if it costs the city of Kent a lot of money, over the investigation that now all of a sudden wasn't good enough because of how some members of the public, but really how members of the media and anti-police activists reacted. I have no doubt that there are obviously some members of the public who are upset. To give you the very brief rundown of what happened, this occurred some time ago, where Camerzell, who is German and has a sense of humor that involves constantly making Nazi references, he was referred to as a character on the Man in the High Castle. It's an Amazon show. It's based on a book. And it envisions a world in which the Nazis were not defeated and still held control. And so there's a character on the show that's an American Nazi who holds the same rank or similar rank as the officer in the Kent Police Department. So people were calling him this guy's name. He ends up putting the Nazi insignia of the general's rank on his door. It was up for a few days. I believe it was 4 days. Detective complains. Camerzell takes it down. Investigation ensues. And he's out for his punishment, 2 weeks of unpaid leave. But he wasn't fired. At the time, Rafael Padilla, the chief of police in Kent, didn't think that it met the bar to fire. Well, now he's out there alongside Mayor Dana Ralph, pushing hard against this officer, and it doesn't sound so good for the cop.
I want to make it crystal clear that the actions of Derek Camerzell should have not happened ever, and that where we are today is that the only suitable resolution to all of this is that he no longer be a part of our police department.
So then why didn't you get
be an officer with us?
Yeah, but why then did you not fire him originally? Why didn't you say that originally, if that's what you truly believe? Now, remember, he is under some criticism, not only for his handling of the Camerzell story, but in a way for what happened with his wife, who runs a social media account for the Kent PD, and I believe now the city of Kent. They ended up blocking certain comments that were critical of all of this, his wife. And all of a sudden, he's taking a very different tone than he did before. But here he is explaining why he didn't fire Officer Camerzell.
The standard of proof that applies to cases in which termination is the potential outcome is the standard of clear and convincing evidence. As I have been well informed by our legal advisors, this is a very high standard of proof, a standard that is much higher than preponderance of the evidence. The very clear and unwavering determination made from a legal perspective was that we did not have clear and convincing evidence to prevail at an eventual arbitration process for the discipline of termination of this employee. Other considerations that also would impact an arbitrator's decision and support or denial of our position includes the employee's work history.
Mm-hmm.
And while during this investigation, several allegations came to light prior to this,
of jokes, by the way, again, bad jokes, jokes that most people would find distasteful, but clearly jokes. We talked about it last week.
This employee had 27 years of service without any prior discipline. From a legal perspective, what that means is this was his first offense.
So his first offense, and by the way, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. If your first offense is, you know, sucker punching a elderly woman as she's walking across the street and you thought gave you a you know, the side eye, that obviously will get you fired and arrested. So this whole idea, well, it's the first offense. No, the reason why he wasn't fired to begin with was because they all acknowledged that it was a joke. It was a bad joke. And they didn't expect the Seattle Times to put as much pressure via their anti-police reporter, Mike Carter, on the department and on the city. Now, Dana Ralph at this meeting, and this was, by the way, it wasn't a press conference. They just both talked in front of a camera for about 30 or so minutes just to give some background on what was going on and why it happened, how it happened. Dana Ralph says that the cop should be fired. The cop should not be working with the Kent PD. And she ends up taking responsibility.
As your mayor, the buck stops with me. Wow. It stops right here. I want you to know that I am committed to moving forward on our response to this issue with transparency, honesty, and integrity. And I want to be engaged with you, our community, as we move forward in the healing process.
Healing. Just real quickly, and I can say this as a Jew, stop with this healing process stuff and stop pretending that words hurt people physically, because they barely hurt emotionally. They can, but no one was the subject of this. No one was the subject of this. I suppose if you were Jewish as an officer working in the department and you saw it, you could then say, yes, this was really shocking and disturbing. But the whole idea that the community, we as a community, we have to heal, that is ludicrous. The people who are pushing this are anti-police activists for the most part. It doesn't mean that there isn't reasonable outrage over this. I don't believe that. I think that there is some. But let's not pretend that activist accounts on Twitter, whose membership you're unaware of, the ownership of the handle you don't know, let's stop pretending that that is a reflection of the community. And let's stop pretending that this story has been reported honestly by the Times. They put Mike Carter on this for a reason. He's the anti-police reporter. That's his beat.
At the end of the day, it is absolutely clear that we have not done enough, and the people of Kent are rightfully holding us accountable. I am grateful for that, and I would expect nothing less from this city.
Yeah, they didn't do enough. There should have been a public flogging before firing. Flog and fire. Alliteration. There you go. Again, you could believe that he should be fired. And I'm certainly open to saying that that is a subjective position. I don't, only because he was very clearly joking. It shows tremendous misjudgment, 100%. But if it was very clearly in the context of a joke, and it was, then no, I don't think someone should be fired for a first-time offense. Do it again? That's different. Now, someone else can hold a completely different position. That's normal. But what I'm not going to allow is folks to put pressure on the Kent Police Department, not because they care about this issue, but because they sense weakness and they can just get another cop. And that's my sense of how this is all unfolding, that there are people there who don't like cops and they're looking at this as a vulnerability within the department, putting the mayor in a really tough spot, putting the chief in a really tough spot, and they are jumping on it. Because then they were able to just get another officer off the force in their push to defund and then ultimately abolish.
The Last Rants.
And then finally, just to recap on yesterday's show where we debunked the rather absurd conspiracy theory about a meeting that's going to happen tomorrow with the Washington State Department of Health, or excuse me, the Washington State Board of Health, where people were claiming that, you know, the Board of Health is about to install different internment camps, and they filed a bill to promote strike teams to go out and capture people and put them in these camps against their will. Oh, and by the way, we're going to forcibly vaccinate your kids in order for them to go to school. 97.3%. I just did the math real quickly. 97.3% of the stories, the blogs from conspiracy theorists, and the memes out there on this are false. And some people continue to claim otherwise. You are doing not just a tremendous disservice to yourself, because no one's going to take you seriously. You're hurting the cause of pushing back against legitimately controversial issues, because people won't believe us when we bring them up. Believing a conspiracy theory doesn't make it less of a conspiracy theory. Being concerned that the state could do this, so you're just going to push it because you feel it's justifiable in the lie, doesn't make it justifiable. In fact, it's acting like progressive activists. And I want to make sure that conservatives don't do that. If you missed my takedown yesterday, just listen to the podcast. It's the first hour. We spent like 25 minutes on it. 25 minutes on it, debunking it. It is not true. And yet I'm still getting emails and calls and texts, which also means we're not doing a good enough job of dispelling it, of debunking it ourselves. So please, if you could, amplify yesterday's audio. This hurts our cause. You can text the keyword podcast to 1-800-465-8770, and I'll send you a link. Let's get it out there. It's the first hour of yesterday's show. It's on the podcast. Make sure you're tuning in. Make sure you're sharing it. And that's The Last Rants.